Chapter 5. Ingredients for Success. To study meteorites is, among other things, to study the history of the solar system. And from a human perspective, the list of significant events from the solar system's approximately 4.5 billion year existence undoubtedly includes the emergence of life on Earth somewhere near the top. Life emerged on our planet somewhere around 3.8 billion years ago, meaning that for over 80% of the time Earth has existed, it has been hosting some form of life. Give or take a few hundred million years, depending on whom you ask. Speculation for the first sign of life extends back to about 4.2 billion years ago, but there is hard evidence by 3.5 billion years ago that Earth was inhabited. That is a long time, but by what means did life emerge in the first place? While the hows and whys of the emergence of life on Earth are questions that have vexed philosophers, religious leaders, and scientists alike for ages, let us touch on the considerably less discussed emergence of ingredients as an important prerequisite to the emergence of life on our blue marble. Ingredients are just raw materials mixed together to form something else. Of course, many people think of making cakes or cookies when they think of ingredients. But making things like plankton, humans, or cuttlefish is arguably more complex than making a cake. Since chemical elements are ingredients that cannot be broken down into any simpler chemical species, that may seem like a good place to start when assembling stuff to build life. However, the bottleneck to the formation of life is not necessarily the presence of certain elements. The key is how elements like carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur are concentrated and combined with one another. These six chemical elements are universal to all known living things. They are commonly given the abbreviation CHNOPS, CHNOPS. For their chemical abbreviations. And since the first four make up greater than 96% of the biomass on Earth, the PS may seem like exactly that. For example, despite having plenty of all those six elements, the Sun has significantly fewer cuttlefish than Earth, demonstrating that the simple existence of specific elements is not the only key for life to develop. Perhaps the most effective way to narrow the scope of important ingredients is to outline the conditions we think are important for life to exist. Of course, one important caveat when we talk about things that we think are essential to life is that everything we know about life comes from life on Earth. There are fascinating thought experiments and research in the field of astrobiology probing what other life in the cosmos could be like. But all life we know of was, or is, constrained to conditions and environments that have been or are present on Earth, using ingredients found on Earth. For a much more thorough discussion of the formation of life on Earth and how it may exist elsewhere in the cosmos, I direct you to the Astrobiology Primer 2.0. This information is what we tether our ideas about life to. And one can imagine that being a problem as we search for different types of critters in different environments. Life may exist elsewhere under vastly different conditions, conditions we may not currently think are suitable for life. Both the solar system and neighboring stellar systems are filled with, at least to us, incredibly strange environments. Within the solar system, things like methane lakes, ice volcanoes, and subsurface oceans exist. And just within our near neighborhood of stars, there are thought to be bodies that rain iron droplets, and planets that have cores made of diamond. Saturn's moon, Titan, has methane lakes. Jupiter's moon, Europa, has a subsurface ocean. And many bodies in the outer solar system, including the former planet Pluto, have what appear to be ice volcanoes. As such, it is understandably difficult to predict how or if life might occur in these types of unfamiliar environments. Yet, regardless of the exact types of environments life has emerged under, on Earth or elsewhere, life must always obey the fundamental laws of physics and chemistry. While we absolutely should let our imaginations run wild with ideas about extraterrestrial life, it is important to always keep in mind certain physical barriers. For instance, any reasonable definition of life includes complex molecules, and the overwhelming majority of complex molecules cannot stay bonded together in temperatures above a few hundred degrees Celsius. Simple organic compounds, such as the amino acids that are common to all known life, completely break down as temperatures get above 200 to 300 degrees Celsius. Many other common molecules found in known life break down at even lower temperatures. Furthermore, our definition of life requires chemical reactions, and extreme environments can restrict chemical reactions. No matter how exciting it might be to try to imagine life existing in conditions such as on the surface of a star, close to absolute zero, or in the almost absolute vacuum of deep space, if no chemical bonding or chemical reactions are taking place, our current definition of life is impossible to achieve. Absolute zero is the physically impossible temperature to reach of 0 Kelvin, which is negative 273.15 degrees Celsius or negative 459.67 degrees Fahrenheit, where atoms stop moving. Methinks the mountains on a Coors Light can would be really blue at 0 Kelvin, but I guess we will never know. But even though these are incredibly stimulating things to think about, we are, for the moment at least, only concerning ourselves with the development of life on Earth. And since we have hard evidence that the environment of Earth has been quite amenable to chemical reactions for its entire recorded history, we are left pondering the provenance of complex molecules on our planet if we want to understand how life developed here. A molecule is simply a grouping of atoms bonded together. This can be combinations of atoms of a single element, such as two oxygen, or O, atoms that make up the O2 in our atmosphere, or the 60 carbon, or C, atoms in the soccer ball-like C60, better known as Buckminster Fullerene. Or this grouping can involve different elements, like the combination of hydrogen, H, and oxygen that makes up water, or H2O. At some point, when a bunch of things are strung together, which frequently involves the element carbon, we start calling these things complex molecules. Ignoring the name, complex molecules can actually be fairly simple with only a few elements involved. Alternatively, they can be enormous strings of complication that comprise the entire genetic code of a human being, as in the case of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. Simple or complicated, molecules that contain the elements carbon and hydrogen are deemed to be organic. This is different from the organic agricultural push of the last few decades to avoid artificial chemicals in food. Because many artificially produced chemicals contain carbon, this is a very confusing choice of terms for chemists concerned about what chemicals they are putting in their bodies. Within this category are commonly known macromolecules, very large molecules, like carbohydrates, proteins, and nucleic acids. Because all known life is carbon-based, organic molecules turn out to be the essential ingredients for life and are almost ubiquitously called the building blocks of life in any textbook or journal article on the subject. Thus, our scope narrows again to look for the source of these organic building blocks. At this point, we can safely state a couple of important things. First, complex organic molecules were required for life to develop on Earth. And second, complex molecules cannot exist at temperatures above a few hundred degrees Celsius. With these knowns, we find ourselves at an interesting place as we try to determine the source of the complex organics on our planet. There is little debate that the Earth, at some point during initial formation, and again after the moon-forming impact, was entirely molten, with surface temperatures well above 1,000 degrees Celsius. As such, chemistry and physics dictate that, had they already existed on the early Earth, no complex organic molecule would have survived the moon-forming impact, The earth flash-melted and became a giant ball of molten rock, a catastrophic process that would have instantaneously evaporated any ocean that might have existed. So, if massive colonies of hyper-intelligent cuttlefish had developed on our planet within 50 to 100 million years after the beginning of the solar system, they, and all of their hyper-intelligently organized complex organic molecules, would have been disaggregated into their most basic constituent phases in the fiery heat when Theia met the proto-Earth to form the moon. And here we are at that oh-so-interesting question. If complex organic molecules had to be available for the first living organisms to self-assemble and for life to emerge on Earth following the moon-forming impact, where did these organic materials come from? By a relatively simple process of elimination, the origin of these ingredients was either 1. Earth, 2. Not the Earth, or 3. Some combination of both. The answer is not only academically interesting, but has far-reaching consequences for our understanding of the development of life and for the probability of finding it elsewhere in the universe. Earth as the source of complex organic molecules. One possible origin of building block organic molecules on our planet was that they were produced on our planet following moon formation. For this to happen, conditions must have been present that allowed for organic molecules to be synthesized abiotically, without life involved. This is a testable hypothesis, assuming we can recreate in the lab the environmental conditions present on Earth over 4 billion years ago, and can wait long enough to see if organic molecules start to populate our beakers. For such an experiment, recreating any specific environment in the lab is relatively straightforward. However, the far bigger hurdle is knowing what environment or environments to recreate. There is plenty of speculation about what the early Earth was probably like, but in reality, we simply don't know. Luckily, scientists are eagerly on the case. Without outlining all the different organic molecules that can be created under such and such conditions, it can be summarized by saying that it is possible to make fairly complex organic molecules without using living things to do it. For instance, in one of the first Origin of Life studies ever published, the famous Miller-Urey experiments of the 1950s show that a variety of amino acids, organic compounds, and ammonia can form when electric discharges interact with things like water, nitrogen, methane, and hydrogen gas. Likewise, similar abiotic reactions can occur to produce complex organic molecules under the conditions present at hydrothermal vents on the ocean floor. So, both in the deep ocean and at its surface, certain ingredients for life can be formed under conditions on Earth that may have existed 4.4 billion years ago. Very cool. However, it is not so easy to make everything we need for our current biosphere with abiotic chemistry on the early Earth. One of the obvious issues is that even though we can engineer abiotic conditions that produce some complex organic molecules, we don't know if those conditions existed in adequate abundance, or even at all, on the early Earth. For example, many of the recreated atmospheres, like the one that you'll find in the enhancement, from early experiments that showed organic molecule synthesis was possible, contained far more hydrogen gas than we now estimate was available on the primitive Earth. Less hydrogen gas in the atmosphere would have produced far less organic material, with less variety, than was produced in these early experiments that got people so excited about the prospect of abiotic creation of organic material on Earth. Additionally, abiotic reactions are characteristically very slow, and the overall yield of biologically useful products can be very low, and would likely be significantly lower outside controlled laboratory experiments. Lastly, these types of reactions can produce entire classes of similar compounds, with only a select few of them being useful for known life. This issue, known as selectivity, is like Trying to do a 5,000-piece jigsaw puzzle with 10 million pieces from different puzzles, all mixed together, that basically look the same. And yet, you have to complete this one detailed puzzle out of a mass of jumbled pieces, most of which don't fit anything on the puzzle you are trying to complete. What about Earth's water? Having complex organic molecules around to tinker with is obviously important if you plan to build things out of complex organic molecules. But there is another critical ingredient for known life on Earth: liquid water. And while it is still actively debated whether or not the presence of liquid water is required for life to exist anywhere else in the universe, it is certainly a big deal for Earth's biosphere and the development of life on our planet. Just for perspective, about half of an average tree is water. Humans are approximately 60% water. And those two examples are things that live on land. Percentages of water go up significantly for water-bound species like dugongs or sea cucumbers. So regardless of whether liquid water is required for any life to exist at all, current life on Earth requires loads of H2O. But where did all of the water on Earth come from? The short answer to that question is that we don't know for certain. The longer answer requires more reading. Our fellow terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, and Mars, have significantly less water than us, but where most of the water on Earth came from is still an active area of research. The leading hypotheses on the primary source of Earth's oceans are very similar to that of complex organic molecules. 1. Earth, or 2. Not the Earth. It is possible that water was incorporated into Earth during the initial accretion process that formed our planet, and we were just lucky enough to keep it around, unlike our neighboring planets. It is also possible that Earth was pretty dry until meteorites or comets delivered water later to the already formed planet, making things like surfing and scuba diving possible in the sloshing H2O excess. And since certain types of meteorites contain a lot of water, some in upward of 15% by weight, some comets have been estimated to be as high as 80% water, it does not take that many meteorites or cometary impacts to account for the world's oceans, so this is less far-fetched than it may initially seem. Similar to any complex organic materials that may or may not have existed prior to the moon-forming impact, liquid water, if it existed on Earth 4.5 billion years ago, would have had some serious issues when the Earth was flash-heated to 1,000 degrees Celsius during moon formation, whereas no liquid water, not even if Earth were covered in deep oceans 4.5 billion years ago, would have survived such high temperatures, that does not mean all of it was lost to space. The massive, invisible leash that is gravity works regardless of whether Earth is molten or not. And this leash would have allowed Earth to hold on to the majority of its hydrogen and oxygen. The constituent elements of water would have been retained following the planetary impact, and, lucky for us, molecular hydrogen, H2, and molecular oxygen, O2, are like old lovers at a high school reunion. As soon as they are near one another, they are gonna hook up. Liquid H2O would reform without too much fuss as soon as the temperature on Earth was low enough for it to happen. This automatic reassembly of water following a planetary disruption is contrary to the behavior of complex organic molecules. The complex organic molecules required to start life would have had to assemble entirely from the most basic organic ingredients to build life, without blueprints if it didn't have outside help. Luckily for us, there are clues buried in organic molecules that can help address the possibility of outside help. The issue of handedness. Much like a Lannister always pays their debts, the element carbon always fills its four possible bonding locations. In simple carbon molecules like methane, CH4, these bonds are basically symmetric. Hydrogen bonded around the central carbon in three dimensions looks and acts the same, regardless of its orientation. However, in more complicated molecules, those four bonds that carbon fills can be occupied by four different things. When these cases happen, you can have molecules with exactly the same formula, say the amino acid alanine, C3H7NO2, but when viewed in 3D, end up with different orientations of the pieces, and therefore different versions of alanine. These are known as chiral objects, objects that look like mirror images of one another, but have different properties. This property is generally described as handedness, as in your right and left hands. They look the same in a mirror, but one is much better suited for signing your name or piloting a toothbrush. In organic chemistry, these different handed molecules are generally designated as the L-type, levorotatory, or left rotation, or D-type, dextrorotatory, or right rotation. The L and D types have the same chemical formula, but they are different and can have different properties. I like to think of this as kind of like tacos and tostadas. The basic ingredients are the same: a tortilla, refried beans, shredded cheese, salsa, and a heap of guacamole. Anything that could go in a taco could also go on a tostada, but they are different dishes that serve different tastes. For instance, bacteria use the D type of the amino acid alanine, whereas we use L-alanine. The antibiotic penicillin destroys D-alanine and therefore kills bacteria and not us, because it only attacks D-alanine. The only chemical difference between L and D, methamphetamine, is that the L form is the active ingredient in nasal decongestants, and the D form is, well, the unfortunately more commonly known form of meth. A less deadly example is that differently handed molecules can smell different from one another. The difference between the smell of lemons and the smell of oranges is only the difference in the handedness of the oil molecule causing the scent. The handedness of various organic molecules may have important implications for our understanding of how life developed on the planet. Abiotic synthesis reactions, like the Miller-Urey experiment shown in the enhancement, form L and D types at the same rate, and a 50-50 mix of the two is the norm for nature. Thanks to thermodynamics, pure L or pure D substance will, over time, always become a 50-50 mix of L-D types. If the rate of change is known, this reaction can be used to determine how long ago something died. But it just so happens that life has strong preferences, and most life, particularly higher forms of life, is made up of only L amino acids. Can it really be an accident of nature? A flip of the carbon coin that life preferentially chose to build from L amino acids instead of its right-handed cousin? Space as the source of complex organic molecules. One of the most basic observations about the origin of life is that in a geologically short amount of time following the moon-forming impact, Earth went from zero complex organic molecules to an amount of life significant enough to leave recognizable traces that are preserved in approximately 4 billion-year-old rocks. We know that some of the organic compounds needed to make this leap could have been produced by potential environments on the early Earth, but could a sufficient amount of organic material be produced to start life up? Could this all have happened quickly enough without outside help? Also, did life self-select one-handedness over the other, or was handedness preordained based on the building material available? Clues to the answers come from meteorites. This is analogous to the debate about spontaneous generation that existed until the mid-1800s. This was also a brain product of Aristotle. Dude was an idea factory. The principal idea of spontaneous generation was that living organisms could spontaneously arise from non-living matter. The classic example was maggots springing to life from dead flesh. How else would they get there? No maggot mother was ever seen, yet there the maggots were after a few days. They must have just materialized from the dead flesh, right? Wrong. But it was not until 1862 that Louis Pasteur performed the experiment that definitively answered the question. In his experiment, Pasteur took a nutrient-rich broth and boiled it in a specially designed swan-neck flask that allowed the exchange of air, but not dust. We now know dust contains microbes. If the broth sat unexposed to the outside world, nothing grew in the broth. However, without the swan neck and exposed to the outside world, bacterial colonies started to take over the broth. In this work, Pasteur essentially showed that if something was sterilized and isolated, it would remain sterile. This led to the process called Louisation, which is used extensively in food storage and safety. Or is it pasteurization? I can never remember. However, if it is exposed to outside forces, the equation changes and the bugs take over. This concept can fairly easily be transferred to our entire planet. The immense heat of the moon-forming impact flash melted and completely sterilized the entire planet by breaking up any complex organic molecules that might have been on Earth at that time. So, unless we were exposed to some outside source, there is no reason to think we would be anything other than a lifeless rock. As we covered earlier, this outside source could also have, arguably, been an inside source where Earth was generating all the organic materials it needed abiotically on its own. However, numerous problems have been identified with this scenario. So, an outside source seems required, at least at some level. But the Earth was exposed to outside forces following sterilization, and as it turns out, those outside forces can contain a surprising amount of complex organic molecules. The amount of material from above. Every day in our modern world, an average of more than 100 metric tons of meteoritic material is added to Earth. That is over 70 VW Gulfs worth of meteoritic material added every single day to Earth. That alone may seem like a lot, but that flux was much higher a few billion years ago, when there was a lot more material in the solar system flying around, looking for a gravitationally stable home to settle down in. Of course, it is the large pieces that garnered the most attention, ending up in museums and on eBay, or causing mass extinctions, of course. But by far, the majority of the material added to Earth comes in the form of unassuming micrometeorites and tiny bits known as interplanetary dust particles, thankfully abbreviated IDPs, that are far too small to see with the naked eye. When it comes to how Earth was built, adding any material to our planet can be significant. However, for this origin of life discussion, it is rather important what type of material was added, as the ancient, sterile Earth needed organic compounds to get the life machine going. And crucially, meteoritic materials, and in particular micrometeorites and IDPs, can contain significant amounts of complex organic compounds, the building blocks of cuttlefish. The specific flavor of meteorites, called carbonaceous chondrites, as the name suggests, contains many carbon-bearing compounds. The relative amounts of carbon-bearing compounds vary significantly between meteorites, but this is partly due to the amount of heat or weathering. Such things destroy many organic components. Each particular sample has seen over its greater than 4.5 billion years floating around space and oftentimes bumpy arrival to Earth. On average, carbonaceous chondrites contain approximately 2 to 4% carbon compounds, which is an impressive amount for a space rock. However, some IDPs contain upward of 80% organic material. This shows that not only does a huge compositional range exist in extraterrestrial materials, but more important, the early Earth must have received a significant amount of organic material from extraterrestrial sources. Based on the measured amounts of organic compounds contained in various meteoritic materials and their calculated fluxes 4 billion years ago, there were over 275 metric tons approximately 200 VW Golfs, of carbon compounds alone added every day to our young planet. With that amount of complex organic compounds raining down after the moon-forming impact, it wouldn't have taken too long to build up a respectable inventory of building material to kick off the soon-to-be-developed biosphere. The content of material from above. While there is little debate that extraterrestrial organics contributed sizably to the carbon budget of the early Earth, when you're trying to initiate life on a fallow planet, the type of contributions can be far more important than volume. As an analogy, the most complicated thing I have ever built would probably be the Lego Death Star. Had I started with only a mass of molten plastic, I certainly would not have been able to finish the job properly. However, I was lucky enough to have all the pre-made pieces required to construct the ultimate imperial weapon, and thus, upon its completion, crush the rebellion of action figures with one swift stroke. If assembly of life followed this Lego analogy, why wouldn't it? Then meteorites did not just provide atoms of elements that are essential for life, the equivalent of molten plastic. They may have provided many, if not all, of the pre-made parts to create life. Of the litany of organic compounds that have been isolated from meteoritic materials, many of them are important building block compounds such as carboxylic acids, amino acids, and ketones. One notable meteorite contains more than 80 distinct amino acids. Living things use only 20 or 21 amino acids to perform their daily functions, and many amino acids discovered in meteorites were previously unknown to exist. Important sugars, such as mannose and glucose, are found in higher abundance in the Murchison meteorite than the element lead is found in the Earth's crust. Of the four nucleotide bases that make up DNA, two have been found in meteorites. Three of the four nucleotide bases that make up RNA have been found in meteorites. Other essential or helpful molecules for life, like aldehydes, dipeptides, purines, aromatic hydrocarbons, etc., are found in a variety of extraterrestrial materials. The enormous list of the organic compounds found thus far in meteoritic samples, which grows every year, is a who's who of the ingredients for life. There's an abbreviated list found in the enhancement. The discovery of a wide array of organic compounds and meteoritic material, of course, leads us to question how such things could exist on rocks that have barreled through space for millions and billions of years. How are there organics in extraterrestrial material? The four most abundant chemical elements in the galaxy are hydrogen, helium, oxygen, and carbon, in that order. As the fourth most abundant element in the galaxy, it makes sense that there would be a lot of carbon-containing compounds, especially those mixed with other abundant things like oxygen and hydrogen, and other top tenors like nitrogen and sulfur. In addition to these elements being abundant, all, with the exception of helium, are chemically very eager to bond. Remember, helium is a chemical snob, a noble gas with a filled outer electron shell that leads to no interest or real ability in bonding with any other elements. So long as these elements are near one another and it's not too hot, formation of the most basic molecules, one or two elements, takes care of itself. The space between and around stars, or the interstellar medium, has vast areas around negative 250 degrees Celsius. These areas are prime for the formation of organic molecules. In fact, well over 100 carbon-containing molecules floating around in the interstellar areas have been identified by remote sensing techniques, confirming organic molecules form and exist in these cold environments between stars. The specific reactions that form each type of complex organic molecule in space is an active and exciting area of research, and not every reaction pathway is fully understood. However, in general, Dust and ice grains are primarily composed of very basic molecules like H2O, CO, CO2, CH4, and NH3. When these basic starting materials are exposed to cosmic rays and/or UV irradiation, both extremely common things in space, new molecules are formed. When this happens over billions of years to trillions and trillions of ice particles, you end up with a very large number of complex molecules that can be incorporated into meteorites, comets, and other space-faring objects when they form in your stellar neighborhood. In the solar system, this would have happened, and is currently happening, somewhere beyond the current orbit of Jupiter, where it is cold enough for ice to persist. Numerous chemical and isotopic studies performed on carbonaceous chondrites strongly suggest that these rocks formed beyond the orbit of Jupiter. This conclusion is supported by various dynamical reconstructions of the asteroid belt, which is heartening. We still have loads of icy particles floating around in the outer solar system today, and there would have been far more when the sun was just getting started. I was astounded when I first learned that meteorites contained even basic organic molecules, and almost in disbelief when I learned major components of our DNA and RNA are embedded in space rocks. Just the existence of these organic molecules in meteoritic material suggests that meteorites played an important role in the development of life on Earth. And even if meteoritic influence was not directly related to the origin of life, delivery of organics to early Earth from meteorites would have, at a minimum, affected the evolution of life and the building materials from which living organisms are made. Much like a primitive MacGyver, development of life on the early Earth would have used what was available. To that end, the incredible overlap between the list of known organic compounds and meteorites and those found in the biosphere is not likely a simple coincidence. In addition, many of the amino acids found in carbonaceous chondrites contain higher amounts of the left-handed variety, in some cases up to 60% more of the L-type than the D-type. The reason why most life developed with left-handed instead of right-handed amino acids could simply be that L-types had an important competitive advantage. There is just simply more of it around. Or, as organics and meteorites expert Dr. Sandra Pizzarello and colleagues put it in their 2006 work, extraterrestrial prebiotic processes might have provided the Earth with a primed inventory of essential organic molecules, holding an advantage in molecular evolution. Additional bioessential ingredients in meteorites. As if the simple delivery of the organic building blocks were not enough of a contribution to Earth's early biosphere, meteorites also contain life-critical components that are often in short supply. Once the first critters started living it up on Earth, however that happened, it would have been crucial for them to access nutrients in order to keep the life party going. One of the most limiting nutrients to life, even in modern times, is reactive and soluble phosphorus. That is why the fertilizer you dribble on your houseplants or farmers spray on their fields is chock full of the stuff. A typical bag of fertilizer from a home store will be upward of 10% phosphorus because it really is what the plants crave. But it's not just plants that crave it. Phosphorus is essential to almost all life functions for all creatures. It's an important structural component of both RNA and DNA. And it's the triply important P in the molecule responsible for energy transfer in humans, ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. Among many other things, phosphorus is also the literal backbone of vertebrates. The main mineral in bones and teeth is apatite, a highly stable phosphate mineral. Even though the element phosphorus is incredibly abundant, the vast majority of phosphorus is locked up in insoluble and/or inaccessible rock forms on Earth, driving the greater than $15 billion a year phosphate mining industry. Of course, the rub for Earth's earliest inhabitants is that this robust mining industry had not yet been established, making the leap from prebiotic chemistry to living critters potentially even more difficult. As you surely have guessed by now, meteorites may have come to the rescue as a critical source of reactive phosphorus. Because phosphorus in meteorites is in a much more reduced form, formed with far less oxygen, it could, and continues to, easily find its way into biology and the life cycle, instead of just being stuck with geology and the rock cycle. As such, early meteorites likely represented an important injection of a much-needed, limiting nutrient as life was just getting started. And lastly, please don't think meteorites of modern times are only good for expensive doorstops and/or collectibles and scientific investigation. They have yet to stop being important delivery vehicles for essential nutrients and raw materials. Even on modern Earth, with the constant recycling of essential nutrients from the massive biosphere and our vigorous mining efforts, there are still nutrient deficiencies in life forms that are constantly being addressed by meteorites. Much like phosphorus, iron is an important component of many of life's functions, but it's not easy to get iron in the form it is needed for biology. Even though there are billions and billions of tons of iron laying around basically everywhere, the vast majority of iron in Earth's crust is highly oxidized iron, or iron-3+. This type of oxidized iron is essentially useless to biological systems because it is insoluble. Biology needs soluble iron, as in iron-2+, which is found in vanishingly short supply, particularly in places like the ocean, where organisms get a lot of the nutrients they require from seawater. This lack of dissolved or bioavailable iron limits productivity in large portions of the ocean. In certain latitudes, wind-blown desert dust contains enough iron that can be dissolved when it lands in the ocean to serve the needs of the marine ecosystem. However, large swaths of the ocean, particularly in the southern hemisphere, don't benefit much from wind deposition and are reliant on other sources of iron. And you can probably guess this source. Plankton, which are arguably the most important organism on Earth, would be far less abundant and productive if it were not for the delivery of extraterrestrial iron from micrometeorites and IDPs. The importance of extraterrestrial iron on ocean productivity has caused some researchers to speculate that the well-documented increased influx of extraterrestrial material around 450 million years ago caused a global increase in marine productivity. If such a productivity bump was intense enough, it would have caused a significant drawdown of global CO2 levels, lowering global temperatures. As such, increased meteoritic delivery may have been the indirect cause of the most intense ice age of the last 500 million years, the Ordovician-Silurian extinction event, which wiped out approximately 85% of marine species at the time. Meteorites giveth, meteorites taketh away. The big picture. It's often said that we are all products of our environments. That statement is routinely applied to situations like when a child grows up in a musical family and learns to play the piano at a high level. They were the product of a musical environment. Sometimes this statement is even applied to biological evolution, like how a certain bird's beak developed to crack a certain type of nut growing in the area. That bird developed, over generations of natural selection, a beak that could access an important food source. But if we are built from organic material delivered from meteorites, then it's also true that we are, ultimately, the products of the environments that existed on ice grains in the outer solar system 4.5 billion years ago, or on a dust particle floating between stars well before our sun even formed. And if it was not incredible enough for you that the organic building blocks that our deep ancestors turned into life were delivered from meteorites, consider that the ubiquity of the raw materials, energy required, and the simplicity of creation means that complex organic molecule-rich bodies are almost certainly commonplace in the universe. If life developed on Earth due to organic materials that formed abiotically in outer space and subsequently were delivered by meteorites to a nurturing environment continually replenished by meteorites, then that suggests that any planetary body in the universe with reasonable conditions for chemical reactions and a little luck has a reasonable opportunity to develop life in some form or another. This is the basis behind the idea of molecular panspermia. The basic building blocks should be present for life to develop in many places in the universe, and as such, life should be a relatively common feature around the cosmos simply because there are a lot of places it could have developed. Future space missions to potentially habitable or previously habitable places like Mars or various moons of the gas giants like Enceladus or Titan will nibble at this idea, at the very least.